Because one of the most important responsibilities we have as we move through our career is to give back and build the bench, delegate and take that risk, let folks learn. And you're there to coach, to assist, to warn. That's a great leadership perspective there.
Hello and welcome back to Leader Up, a podcast of Army Management Staff College. Leader Up is a professional conversation where we discuss a broad range of leadership and leader development topics with an emphasis on the Army civilian professional. I'm your host, David Howie. And on today's episode of Leader Up, we have a very special guest from the intelligence community. And our guest today is Ms. Catherine Coviello. And Ms. Coviello, I want to thank you for giving up your time today and being a guest on Leader Up. Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'm very excited to be here. Thank you for having me.
Well, you're quite welcome. It's always a pleasure to have some of our senior folks come in and spend their time talking to our audience. I want to start off with just a little bit about your background and how you got to the position that you're in now. And if you could also in that explain the grade that you're at and that system in the intelligence world.
Sure thing. So I am approaching a total of 34 years combined federal service. I started out like many in uniform. I had 12 years in uniform, mostly in the reserve component, both in the Guard and in the reserve. And in the civilian space, I came in initially as a military technician while serving in the Guard, and then transitioned a year or two later to become an intern with the Army's Military Intelligence Civilian Accepted Career Program, also known as MICEP. And that you start as the GS-7, spent 2 years in the MICEP internship, and then transitioned over into the Signals Intelligence specialty. Both of those locations were at Fort Meade. Came up through the ranks, assigned to, believe it or not, Army Materiel Command for 7 years up at Fort Monmouth, New Jersey, where I worked on different projects and programs of record, then transitioned to the Army staff for 2 years before taking an opportunity with the Office of the Undersecretary of Defense for Intelligence, where I served for just over 8 years before moving here to Redstone Arsenal, coming back to the Army this time. My role became that as a intelligence community senior leader corps member, specifically as a defense intelligence senior level civilian executive. These are positions that are considered SES equivalents by the Office of Personnel Management. We serve predominantly in an advisory and technical expert role and not somebody that leads or manages a large organization, but we are used for our expertise in specific areas. My role as the command's intelligence and security advisor is pretty broad. We've got over 160,000 people in the command in over 70 countries. And the intelligence role in my space, specifically, I look at foreign intelligence matters, not criminal intelligence matters, even though we have people that work with CID on that. And then the security space, it crosses all aspects of security, from cybersecurity to information security to force protection, operation security, et cetera. It's been quite the journey. I've had to move a couple times. When I was at the Pentagon, the good thing was it was just moving to another ring and corridor in the Pentagon. I didn't have to relocate my home. But I've had to do permanent change of station, PCS moves a couple times, which includes, in my case, moving a couple of four-legged children with me, which can be exciting, and you have to do all the logistics that come along with that as well. So I'm very fortunate to have had opportunities. I have had to make some significant sacrifices, making choices, whether you move or not, whether you take a position that's new so that there aren't a lot of processes and SOPs in place, whether you assume a detail so you can strengthen yourself in an area where you're maybe not as strong as you need to be, such as resource management, And I've had some great mentors along the way, amazing teammates, amazing colleagues, amazing bosses. It's been quite the journey.
And that's one of the differences between the system that you're in as opposed to us down here in the 15 and below range, is that you basically, when you're called to move somewhere, that's basically what happens. That's part of the responsibility for having that grade, is that you're called upon to move around and go different places. Is that correct?
So the Army, through its Civilian Senior Leader Management Office, requires all of its civilian senior executives, including DISLs, Defense Intelligence Senior Levels, and DICES, Defense Intelligence Senior Executive Service Members, to sign mobility agreements. Now, DISLs and their non-intelligence equivalents of senior level and senior technical executives, we tend to be more difficult to move because you may be the nanotechnology expert for the Army, or the high energy laser expert for the Army, or the open source intelligence expert for the Army. You're not as much of a generalist as the main SES core. They are a little bit easier to port around. That doesn't mean that they don't move. It's just a little more difficult because you're not going to put a round peg in a square hole.
Right. And I'm just curious, your background when you were in uniform and as an Army civilian was in the intelligence world?
Yes, it was. Initially, believe it or not, my military technician time, I was a training specialist, as it was a GS-7 training specialist. But I was the training specialist in a Division G2. So I was in an intelligence organization, but helping them with training matters, getting courses scheduled, getting mobile training teams scheduled, that type of thing. I've also been in different spaces within the intelligence community where I've worked, for example, heavily in resource management or heavily in policy development. My last job, I had to author a defense instruction, a DoD instruction and a DoD directive, and help other organizations on the OSD staff adjudicate and advance DoD directives and instructions in various areas tangential to intelligence, such as biometrics or electronic warfare, where they maybe needed some help getting the buy-in from the intelligence community.
Okay, I would like to jump in and talk about some leadership topics, because I've heard you talk about these as a guest speaker in other forums. And I just really want my Leader Up audience to hear these from you, because I think they're very exciting and they're very, very illuminating. And the first one is something that you refer to as the frozen middle. What is the frozen middle?
I did some reading over the weekend trying to find where it originated. I think I first encountered it in a Harvard Business Review professional reading. That's, at least in the civil service side, it's your GS-12s, 13s, 14s, in some cases 15s, that are responsible for getting the mission done, getting operations taken care of, achieving results day in, day out at the operational and tactical level. Sometimes, because they're so focused on immediate outcomes, they're difficult to convince to change. And it's hard for them to lead change because they see the immediate existential concerns. I need to get this task completed. I need to get the load for this ship scheduled. And they don't have the opportunity often to look up and see the strategic outcomes and where maybe the process can be advanced. And often they haven't even been exposed to the processes that allow for change to happen. So they're really good at what they're doing. It's just hard for them to change. And a lot of what I do is mentoring and some informal coaching of employees, both within the command and within the intelligence community writ large. And they'll say, you know, my boss told me I can apply for this program. It's just not a good time. We would love to let you go. You're just so important right now. We can't let you go. Because that frozen middle, those middle management members see that it's going to cause a ripple in their team to unplug somebody to attend, for example, the Command and General Staff College satellite course for 3.5 months, not looking at the long-term effect that that team member is going to come back with more recipes, more success stories, a better network, and improve the team. And in the long term, that investment will pay off 3, 4, 5-fold. It's a challenge for folks to navigate that space. I did a leadership professional development session for the National Ground Intel Center down in Charlottesville, and they actually teed that up to me. They said, we need help in getting past this because we're stuck here. So that got me researching it. And then as part of my leadership professional development session that I do for organizations, I help them come up with tactics, techniques, and procedures for those members of their workforce to navigate that space, being mindful that that management, that branch chief, that division chief, that unit section chief still has to deliver results, but they also have to invest and take risk in their most important resource, which is what their people are.
And that kind of reminds me of the fact that back in 2019, we added leadership into our Civilian Corps creed. So we used to just say, I provide stability and continuity. And now we've added leadership as if to remind ourselves that we can't just keep our heads down and look at the day-to-day grind. But as you're saying, with this frozen middle, sometimes we got to pull those people out of that fight and develop them in ways so that they are more productive in the fight.
Absolutely. That's truly where you get your long-term gains. And a lot of what I end up doing myself is leading from the middle. I'm not in a formal management supervisory position. So I'm helping people navigate that, helping them in some ways manage up. Hey, boss, I want to go to Command and General Staff College. I'd like to attend the Naval War College. I'd like to go on this developmental assignment or civilian expeditionary workforce opportunity, and I'm going to put it on my individual development plan. I'm going to help you get resources to cover down while I'm gone. I'm going to make sure I have tight continuity books and standard operating procedures so that the team doesn't miss a beat because I'm deployed to Germany supporting an exercise or what have you.
And so what you're saying is that if I'm in that frozen middle, the 12, 13, 14, 15 grade, if I'm going to go to my chain of command and ask for an opportunity to be supported, you're suggesting that it's incumbent on me to do as much of the homework as I possibly can to anticipate the resources and try to do something about those challenges that I know my boss is going to come back at me when I go in and ask to go off to training. And if I've been the problem solver, solving those problems, it's going to make it a lot more palatable for my chain of command to let me go.
You are spot on with that. I myself was looking at a program when I was assigned at Fort Monmouth, New Jersey, then called the Intelligence Community Officers Program. And I wanted to go out and do a rotation. And I had a boss, and he's a smart guy. He was an engineer. And he said, we'd love to let you go, but. So I came back to him and I said, okay, if I get you two people to come in on rotation while I rotate out to cover down on this mission set, to cover down on this support to the program, is that an acceptable alternative? And he said, write up the requirements, run it by me, and we'll see where it goes. So that was how to get to yes.
Yes, and that is one of the challenges that we have in the Army Civilian Corps, is that grade level that you're talking about. And even getting them away for 3 weeks for an intermediate course or 4 weeks for the advanced course can be a challenge for some organizations.
Truly, that is a concern. I myself am a little bit of a, personality-wise, a strategizer. I plan my vacations 8 to 18 months out in advance. I tell managers, listen, your employee could be up for 4 weeks with major surgery. They could get a new job. You have to figure out how to cover down and how to let them go. Go and grow. I like to use the, I'm going to paraphrase Henry Ford. He had a saying that he was talking to one of his managers, and his manager said, listen, if we let these folks go to training, they might leave. And Henry Ford said, but if we don't, they might stay. So he was thinking strategically, we're not going to have better people. I'm going to take the risk and let them go to training, let them go to grow. Maybe they do leave. Maybe they come back later on stronger because they've been somewhere else and learned other skills. So leaders have to figure these things out. And the beauty is elements such as the Enterprise Civilian Talent Development Program, formerly known as the Senior Enterprise and Enterprise Talent Management Program, have come up with a myriad of options. Everything from part-time details to virtual details to short timeframes to do leadership shadowing that can be spread out over several months to allow managers to provide these opportunities to their civilians that maybe haven't had the chance to leave the organization. We have people here in Alabama that run farms. They get up at 4 a.m, they take care of their livestock. They go and take a shower, come in and do their job for 8+ hours, and then they go home, and then they take care of their livestock. It's not easy for somebody with those responsibilities to unplug and disappear for 4, 6, 8 weeks. The beauty is that the Army has recognized these limiting factors and adjusted and modernized their training opportunities so that it can be done in a variety of delivery methods and achieve the same result.
Let's go back 25 years ago, quarter of a century. Mm-hmm. Army civilians back then really were just kind of button pushers, technicians, and we weren't asked to develop ourselves or to be part of the leadership in an organization. But in the past, I'll say 25 years or so, Army civilians have been called upon a lot more to develop, to get better, and not just get better in their skills, but in leadership skills, broadening, understanding the Army, being able to make decisions that are informed, that are wise about the overall health of the organization.
I must agree with you in almost all of that. I will mention that having come into the Army as a intelligence intern, we had a pretty good structure that the intelligence community provided for us for leadership development and training. But it wasn't mainstream Army stuff. It was intelligence community stuff. As an intern, we had the intern leadership development program. And then beyond that, if you were fortunate, somebody steered you towards the Army Management Staff College at Fort Belvoir. When it was there, I knew one coworker that went there, and I said, "How did you know about this? How did you do this?" Because these weren't mainstreamed, and I have to tip my hat to civilian senior executives that have really set us up for success in this space, like Mr. Carl Schneider, who was the OAA with the Army before he retired. He really saw the need to invest in our civilian workforce to make them competitive, to make them in some ways equally prepared as those members of the workforce that came in after a 20 or 25 year military service stint. Look at the officers and the non-commissioned officers. They're in a class 1 out of every 4 or 5 years, whether it's their basic officer leadership course, whether it's the Sergeant Major's Academy, War College, Senior Service College, fellowships, everywhere in between there, your civilians don't get that kind of opportunity. So they had to figure out, how do you still deliver your mission and role as an Army civilian, but do it in a manner that's not disruptive to their personal requirements at home and also not disruptive to their work requirements in the office. So the stuff that the Enterprise Civilian Talent Development Program offers, it's amazing. it's continuing to grow and to advance. Just this past year, for example, they leveraged the talent marketplace that the military members have been using. They leveraged that to come up with the TDY project selections for those folks who had applied and those organizations that had offered opportunities. They did that matchmaking service. So again, continuing to modernize and provide amazing opportunities.
I'd like to turn to another concept that I heard you talk about this, and it is this delineation between being the fire chief and the fire man or the fire person. And what's the significance of that delineation?
Yes, that's a great analogy that was posed to me when I was seeking some mentoring from one of my intelligence executive colleagues. And he said to me, he said, "Kathy, you have a choice, but do you want to be the fire chief or do you want to be the fireman?" And maybe I was a little slow on the uptake, but I had to think about that for a while. And it's an analogy. So the fire chief is, you are technical. You are not in a formal leadership position, leading a division or organization, but you are the technical expert at what you do. Your job is to put out fires, literally, in this case, at a fire department. You get to drive the fire engine. You get to climb the ladder. You get to spray the hose and the foam. You get to chop down the door and rescue the kitten or the baby from the burning structure. And that is really important because the whole department is important. And without firemen, the fire chiefs wouldn't have a need to exist. The fire chief is there to enable, through management and leadership, the resources and the rules, or in some cases we call it policy, to allow the firemen to do their job. The fire chief has to make sure there's money in the budget to pay for the foam. The fire chief has to make sure there is sufficient maintenance to keep the fire engines up and running. The fire chief needs to manage personalities on the team. If William and Walter are not getting along, maybe they're not ride on the same fire truck, right? They have to figure that out and then figure out how we can get them to ride on the same fire truck when necessary. They're both very important roles. One is not lesser than the other. And when I was talking to a group of folks out in Arizona last week, I told them, I said, you have to think about it. Where are your preferences? You know, I asked them by a show of hands, I said, if I could pay you $200,000 a year, and I just threw an easy number up, to do what you do as a technical person or as a supervisor of technical people, how many of you would be a supervisor? And a show of hands went up. And then how many of you would opt for technical? And another show of hands went up. Now, believe it or not, this entire group was made of supervisors. And I told them that's okay. Supervisory duties are challenging in their own way. They have other technical aspects on the HR side, human resources side. They have technical aspects on the performance management side and on the budgetary side. And it's okay. If you don't want that, there's nothing wrong with that. If you want to stay technical, we need you on the team. That's important too. Now, what happens is as people look to advance in their careers, often they'll take the fire chief job because it's a pay raise, not because it's really what they want to do. And they may grow into the role, or they might be miserable. So I asked them to think about it, do some self-reflection. If you had a choice between the fireman and the fire chief, what direction would you go? My current role is that of a fireman. Now, I am the technical expert fireman, and I do some of my own leadership from the middle. I'm helping folks see opportunities. I'm helping them discover resources. But I'm not a decision maker. I'm in an advisory role. Again, a valued member of the team, but not in charge.
And if I sign up to be the fire chief, I kind of have to realize that my days of climbing up the ladder and physically putting out fires or rescuing kittens or whatever the case might be, those days may be over for me, and I need to not try to continue to do those things if I have signed up to be a supervisor. Is that correct?
I would say that is for the most part correct. You maintain a level of street credibility, if you want to call it street cred, if you can still climb the ladder, or they have a video of you climbing the ladder in your younger days. You want to understand, at least at a good working level, the roles of those that are serving in the firemen roles. And oh, by the way, you know, technology and the global environment is changing what the technical folks are doing. So you have to stay current, but you really need to work hard to fight for those resources, to enable the firemen, and to fight for the policies, to give them what they need to do their jobs to their utmost.
Yeah, and I know when I was in charge of the public affairs office here at Fort Leavenworth, it took me a while, but I finally realized this phrase of work yourself out of a job. I purposefully took myself away from any of the day-to-day functions that the office needed to be done to move forward, because I felt like I could get called away to a meeting at any time. And if my office was depending on me to decide something or to do something, I was holding them back. And so I delegated everything out. If I was gone for an afternoon or for a day, the office would continue to function as it needed to, specifically with the Post newspaper. It's always fun to go in and micromanage the headlines and pick photos and things like that. That's the fireman's job. And I realize that my job is to get out of that business and try to look more so at the big picture.
And that is so powerful, because one of the most important responsibilities we have as we move through our career is to give back and build the bench and delegate and take that risk. Let folks learn. You're there to catch them if they're going to fall. Maybe they skin their knee once, right? But you're there to catch them to make sure that nothing illegal, immoral, unethical happens. But they also have to learn to ride that bicycle without the training wheels, to ride the bicycle and push off by themselves. And you're there to coach, to assist, to warn, right? Hey, watch out. Hey, there's a hurricane coming. We might want to hit this deadline early so we can get everybody safely home. That's some of the magic there. And I've had bosses that have allowed me to do that, have allowed me to learn, in many cases to fail, so that I never made the mistake again, right? So that's a great leadership perspective there. I agree with you on that.
Yeah, and there's that old analogy. We talk about this, or used to in the classroom, about the butterfly and its wings. And if you don't let the butterfly break out of its chrysalis or cocoon on its own, It's the wings will not develop enough strength for it to be a healthy butterfly. And so you think you're helping it by breaking the cocoon open or the chrysalis, and in fact, you're not helping. You're doing great damage to that organization when you, quote unquote, help too much, or you don't realize that your job is, as the chief, you're not supposed to help too much. You're supposed to kind of watch and let people make decisions on their own.
You know, when I was a kid, I actually got it big time into studying butterflies. So I know exactly what you're talking about. We actually grew our own. You ordered one, a kitten, and you watch them. You'd feed them. They'd feed them whatever leaves they were eating. These were painted lady butterflies. And you watch them, and they'd go into their pupa, right, or their chrysalis, right? And then you watch them break out, and they had to, you know, flap their wings to get them to dry off, flap their wings to get the circulation going, to strengthen the membranes. So eventually they could fly, and then at some point you would let them out of their container, and they would go out to the wild and do what butterflies do, be awesome pollinators.
I'd like to switch gears and talk about something that might seem a little out of place on a leadership podcast, but I noticed when you came and talked to one of our classes, it was the Cecil BT class, your first slide, you had a kind of a summary of your background. And one thing that you had on there that caught my eye was that you are an avid equestrian, and you talked about the four-legged family members earlier that you had to move. And so I saw that you are a horseback rider, and I think you said you do dressage. I know a little bit about that. My wife and my daughter are both dressage riders. I wanted to ask you about that from this perspective of why is it important for you personally or for other senior leaders, people who are dealing in some cases with matters of life and death, we're making decisions that affect people or people's careers in very dramatic ways. Why is it important, or why has it been important for you to have, and I'll use this word, a passion or an outlet. I don't like the word hobby because I feel like that trivializes these things that we have. Why is it important for you to have kind of that outside passion to kind of keep the fires burning in your heart?
No, I appreciate that very much. I just completed an engaging and encouraging employees course, and we talked about during the sessions that we, the breakout sessions we had, about how important it is to have part of you that is outside of the office, because for many, many reasons, the equestrian sport it's a sport. It's an Olympic level sport for a reason. It's actually hard. The horse is doing a lot of work, but you're doing a lot of work as well. It's a great place, I believe, mentally, because when you're riding your horse, or if you're driving your horse, if you do carriage driving or something like that, you must be present and in the moment. If I am on my horse and I think about anything in the office, there's a good chance I'm going to end up on the ground.
Right.
So you learn to mentally, not quite compartmentalize, but to turn things off and give yourself time to focus on the task at hand, the relationship in this case with a four-legged animal with the brain the size of a walnut, but they're pretty darn smart when you think about it. The dressage, which is a French word for training. It's the Olympic sport where you see the horses dancing in the sandbox, if you want to think about it that way. Many people call it the thinking rider sport because there's a lot of strategy involved. There's a lot of preparation. I'm not as athletic as I used to be, but my brain's pretty good. So I can often beat younger, more physical folks because I mentally prepare myself to do the pattern that we're assigned. I'm very tactical and strategic in how I move into a particular movement in the arena. And if you get people with accuracy, and if you get folks with consistency, it allows you to be successful. I like the sport as well because you're getting scored, similar to how they score the figure skaters or the gymnasts or what have you. But you can set goals for yourself, because I might be riding in a competition with a kid from the pony club or the 4-H club, but I might be also riding in a competition with an Olympian. So I want to ride against the standard. Because where you place depends who shows up that day. It's, again, a great stress relief in my case, because it's physical. You spend probably about 80% of your time getting ready to and cleaning up for riding, and then the other 20% of doing the riding activity that you're getting your steps in, you're getting your circulation going, you're getting fresh air, you may be applying sunscreen because the SP, you know, the sun level is, the ultraviolet level is pretty high down here. It's really important. And as you move through your civil service career, you get pretty generous leave. I actually earn 4 hours a week of leave, annual leave, plus 4 hours for pay period of sick leave. So that gives me time, if I so choose, to go ride my horse or what have you. I also was remembering with a friend of mine earlier, we had a boss at the Pentagon, pretty senior guy, and my friend was his military assistant, and they learned that it was important to get the boss to the gym every morning. And he wasn't in uniform. He was a retired military member, but he was a civil servant. And getting him to the gym gave him place to think, gave him the oxygenation to have clarity of thought. It reduced his stress level. And when you get back to the office after a good ride or a good session on the elliptical or whatever your passion may be, maybe you're a little happier. Maybe you've had time to reflect and put things in perspective. I really think that we need to work on managing stress as leaders. I myself am a a participant in the Army's wellness program, which is where you can work out on the clock. The Army policy is up to 3 times a week, 1 hour per day, up to 80 hours per year. I put it on my calendar and I work out with a personal trainer. And what that shows is for people that are watching me, hey, it's okay to take time to take care of you. I used to tell myself, be selfish, because I felt like I was, you know, I have this duty passion, right? That I need to deliver this, I need to produce that, but I also need to take care of my health. That helps me be a better leader. It helps me be a better member of the team. It helps me produce better product. You know, I'm working on some slides for an effort I'm doing next week in coordination with our G1. I guarantee you, if I'm stuck in a spot, I'm stuck on a thought, I don't know whether the next step is, if I go out and get some exercise, even if I just do some yoga and meditation, I will think clearer and I will produce better. And then again, remember, someday the government, the Army is going to be outside of our lives, right? We all hopefully someday get to do something next. And it's important to have a purpose beyond coming to the office every day. I worked in senior services a little bit after college at the town where I lived, and we had a lot of shut-ins, and we would have to explain to them, you must come up with something every day that gets you up and gets you out of the house, even if it's just going to get a cup of coffee at McDonald's, because you can quickly become a shut-in, and loneliness does harm to you. Being alone, being isolated does harm to you. Have a reason, have a purpose. Your work is your purpose, but you have to have purpose in addition to that. And for me, I do a little bit of volunteerism, but my happy place outside of work is indeed at the barn with an N, B-A-R-N.
Yes. You know, the horseback riding can also teach you a little bit about that fire chief and fireman analogy, because if you're the rider, you have to let the horse do the work. And the more you try to make them do it or think that you can do it on your own, not going to be successful. You've got to create a partnership with that animal to be successful.
It's incredible the amount of behavioral stuff you learn. You know, a horse can feel when a fly lands on it.
Right.
So when I ask my horse the pressure from my calf to step to the right while we're trotting forwards and into something called a half pass, and she ignores me, I know she's ignoring me. So I have to say, okay, did I not properly prepare her for this? Do I need to change the timing of my aid? You have to be in charge, but you also have to let, in case of dressage, get them into what they call self-carriage, which is comes with the more advanced training. And that's where you get the beautiful movement that you see in the Olympics.
Right. And we have to do the same thing when we're supervisors with the folks that we're supervising, is to recognize they didn't get it today and it's not their fault. Maybe it's mine. Maybe it's something I need to do differently.
I like that analogy and owning that as a leader, that you are responsible. It is my fault. If we fail, it is my fault. I am to blame. Take ownership of that. Folks are quick to claim success, but we also have to be quick to own that failure. You know, look at those lessons learned, or as the Brits call them, lessons observed. You know, moving into a half pass across the center line. How do I prepare myself coming out of that corner so I have a better result the next go around? So I get a better score. So I have, you know, a better outcome. And then honestly, with my horse, the trainer rides her a level higher than I do. So she's doing what we call flying changes of lead. And come on, I'll say, listen, if we get this on the first try each way, we can call it quits after 5 minutes and go for a trail ride. So there's a little bit of a negotiation there as well.
Okay. And I would like to talk about a little bit more about the grade that you're in and the symbol of that grade. When I have members of the SES on our podcast, we talk about the keystone and why that's important. Your grade system has a pin that looks like the keystone, but it's a little bit different. And we're going to put an image of this up on our show notes page when we publish this, but just tell our audience a little bit about the pin that you wear and its significance.
I have a pin as the Defense Intelligence Senior Level member that denotes that I am a member of the Intelligence Community Senior Leader Corps and that I have attained that, including certification for joint duty, civilian joint duty, unlike the military joint duty. So it's the Keystone pin, similar to what you see in SES wear, but it has a circle in the middle that is purple and then a star in it. And that purple signifies joint. And that requirement is mandatory for all intelligence community executives. We must spend at least 1 year out of our home agency. So if you work for the Army, you have to spend at least 1 year on a detail or have spent at least 1 year assigned somewhere else outside of the Army. So you could be assigned to the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, or you could work for the Department of Energy in their intelligence and security spaces, or you might have worked for Marine Corps intelligence. And that requirement emerged as a result of the 9/11 Commission, which looked at what caused the failure to warn, what caused the strategic surprise that caught our nation unprepared, similar to Pearl Harbor, right? And the 9/11 Commission had a finding that said, hey, intelligence community, you guys need to integrate better. You need to talk to each other. You had all the information, but you failed to connect the dots and provide warning about this terrible thing that happened. So the 9/11 Commission resulted in the Intelligence Reform and Terrorism Prevention Act of 2004. And in there, it said, hey, intelligence community, before any one of you become a senior in the community, you must have spent at least 1 year. You must attain this joint duty certification. And that helps you better integrate, because if you've only spent your time in Army intelligence, if you've only spent your time with the CIA or the FBI, you aren't going to know how to collaborate and integrate with the rest of this significant, powerful, and highly functional organization out there called the intelligence community. I myself spent a small amount of time on a detail at the intelligence community management staff, which existed before the Director of National Intelligence stood up. And then I also spent over 8 years at the Office of the Undersecretary of Defense for Intelligence. That gave me a very different perspective than if I had stayed only with Army intelligence. It gave me more connections. It gave me more understanding of how strategic issues were resolved. For example, when I was on the community management staff, I was assigned to work the document and media exploitation issue paper, similar to a palm planning test that the Army knows. And I had a basic understanding of the topic. By the time I was done, I was the person that everybody was coming to get help on how do I get resources for this? How do I make sure that my systems are interoperable? And it just let you see the power of the community as a whole. That's how our symbol is a little bit different. So DICES, Defense Intelligence Senior Executive Service Members, CISs, which is a Senior Intel Service Member, or SNIS, Senior National Intel Service Members, we are all provided with that pin by the Director of National Intelligence. I have a photo in my office that when that was provided to me. It's different, but it's important because it shows that you can be part of a larger effort at the national level.
And the final thing that I'd like to talk about today, ma'am, is just the people that are in the GS ranks that perhaps would like to have a position such as yours or to serve at higher levels in the Army or in all of DOD at that senior level. What kind of advice would you have for the GS 9, 10, 12, 13s out there who kind of see the ceiling coming grade-wise and they want to go further? What kind of advice would you have for those people?
And I think, what would I have told myself so many years ago? Part of my drive was always to do the best that I can and provide the most service that I could. So you really need to think about what your reason for being, you know, the TED Talks of get behind the reason for why. Why are you here? What do you want to achieve? What are you willing to sacrifice? What are you not willing to sacrifice? Do some self-study on that. And you might do that well with either a coach and or a mentor, because they can help you walk down that conversation. Because you may get to the point where you say, hey, I'm a GS-13. I'm making a pretty decent salary. I like my work-life balance. I really like the town where I live, or I really like the city where I live. And I like my office. I'm good here, and that's okay. But you also may say, hey, I think I can do more. Work with a mentor or mentors, multiple mentors. I always tell folks, have more than one. Find a coach if you can. The Army has a great coaching program and opportunities for folks to be coachees. Look what's out there. I mentioned the Enterprise Civilian Talent Development Program. I will advocate for that as much as possible. I have seen people grow. I have seen people get promoted after, or earn promotions, earn new jobs, right? Or earn a different job that they wanted somewhere else by going through that program and broadening themselves. I'm a child of educators. I very much believe in learning. And the learning doesn't have to be a class for 40 hours. It might be a podcast that you listen to while you're at the gym. It may be a webinar that you attend on duty or off duty or what have you. It may be some reading that you do. There's a lot of ways to learn and grow. I myself was very fortunate to attend and graduate from the National Intelligence University, which is similar to a senior service college. It gets a JPMA certification, I think level one. And that was something that had always been on my radar screen. And I worked hard to be able to attend, made some sacrifices, drove from New Jersey to Washington, D.C. every weekend for 2 years. But wow, the stuff I learned, the relationships I made with classmates from all across the community, the journey of learning that I was able to gain from that program, which included a thesis, which was very much a journey, not the destination. Things like that help you get on that path. They prepare you. Seek those opportunities. If they need somebody to escort a VIP that's visiting, sign up to do that. You'll get exposed to leaders and get to sit in the back of the room and hear conversations that you wouldn't have heard if you stayed in your cubicle or working on your production line or wherever you may be assigned. Look for different opportunities, find them where you can. And then again, do that reflection. Decide, how much do you want to sacrifice? I would encourage folks not to sacrifice their health. I was asked by some young troops at Fort Belvoir last month, if you could give your 20-year-old self a message, what would you say? And I'd say, do not sacrifice your health. Take the time to take care of your health, because that's a very, very precious thing that by the time you realize it, it's too late. Think about it. I applaud folks that say, I want to be an SES. That was never my goal. My goal was to make the most difference that I could, to be the best that I could and serve the best that I could. This opportunity presented itself. I competed, was fortunate to be selected for the job. Feel very fortunate to serve every day, both the command, the Army, the intelligence community, and more importantly, the people around me that I work with around the world.
And I like that advice that you gave about start with why. Why do you want to pursue this? People who want to go to a higher level and it's about the paycheck, the parking space, or the corner office, that's really not what that person's probably going to be disappointed if that's their motivation, things like that.
I totally agree with you on that. I call that the icing on the cake that sometimes you wish you didn't have. Right. You know, I have a personal friend that he was a Dietzel and he decided he wanted to return to the 15 ranks because he wanted to do something different and serve in a different way. And believe it or not, if you look at total compensation, a 15 living overseas, where you get the housing allotment, in the end takes home more than a civilian senior executive. You don't do it because of the paycheck. And again, many, many of us could go to corporate, go to academia and make more on the outside. You know, the paycheck is a wonderful, wonderful benefit, but that's not why you're doing it.
Absolutely. Ms. Catherine Coviello, I want to thank you for giving up your valuable time and coming and being a guest on Leader Up and talking to our audience about these topics. Thank you so much for your time and for being a guest on Leader Up.
Well, it's been an absolute privilege and a delight to be here. I am going to continue to pass the word to the Dicels and Dicies in the Army about this opportunity. I know you've had a couple of us on, but I think you can have some more. And I am also linked in with a lot of the senior technical and senior level non-SES members of the Army. And I want to highlight this opportunity for them to share. And, again, a lot of great introspection in this conversation. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, ma'am. It's been a great pleasure talking with you today. And so, Leader Up audience, what did you hear from Ms. Coviello? What did she talk about that kind of got your attention? Are you a supervisor? Are you a fire chief, maybe, that sometimes gets pulled into being the fireman when you really should be taking a broader look at things in your organization? Are you in that muddy middle where you feel like you can't pull away to go do developmental opportunities? Those things appeal to you? Do some reflection about that. And make sure to subscribe to our podcast and join us again for another edition of Leader Up.
As always, if you have any questions or feedback or would like to learn more about our podcast, please check the description for our email and for our website. Thanks for listening.